right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Justice advocates and lawmakers are calling on the Trump administration to put a family reunification plan in place for the thousands of children taken from their parents while crossing the southern U.S. border. AP's Julie Walker reports.
Democratic State Senator Brian Benjamin's East Harlem district includes the Cayuga Center, where he says 239 immigrant children taken from their parents are receiving services. He's especially concerned about a baby there.
9 months of age, separated from their mother at the border, brought to New York from Texas.
He also says a 9-year-old Honduran boy seeking asylum was bused here from Texas.
Put on a bus. 2,000-mile journey to New York.
More than 2,300 children were taken from their families at the border in recent weeks. A senior Trump administration official said hundreds of them have been reunited since May. Julie Walker, New York.
Turks voted Sunday in a presidential and parliamentary election that posed the biggest ballot box change and challenge to Tayyip Erdogan and his Islamist-rooted AK party since they swept to power more than a decade and a half ago. The vote will also usher in a powerful new executive presidency long sought by Erdogan. According to officials, an explosion at a campaign rally for Zimbabwe's president that injured 49 people will not delay next month's election. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa escaped injury in that explosion in a campaign rally on opposition stronghold. State media called the attack an assassination attempt. The president said there have been so many attempts on his life that he's used to them. This is VOA News. The U.S. military has relocated wooden coffins containing the remains of 100 American soldiers who have been missing from the 1950 to 1953 Korean War. They put them and sent them to the inter-Korean border in preparation for North Korea's eventual return of the remains to their home country. The AP's Ben Thomas reports.
The U.S. military says it's moved 100 wooden coffins to the joint security area at the border between North and South Korea. That's in preparation for North Korea's return of the remains of missing American soldiers from the Korean War.
President Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, says he doubts whether Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has the ability and the willingness to make a peace deal with Israel. He has his talking points, he said, which have not changed in the last 25 years. There's been no peace deal achieved in the time, Kushner said in an interview published in Palestinian newspaper. Kushner also said the Trump administration is almost done with an Israeli-Palestinian peace plan that has been created without any input from the Palestinians. Kushner and U.S. envoy Jason Greenblatt held talks with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Friday and Saturday. Before meeting with Netanyahu, the two men visited Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Egypt. Kushner said that the Arab leaders are in favor of a Palestinian state. Abbas has not seen Kushner and Greenblatt following Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and his decision to move the U.S. embassy there. Palestinians see East Jerusalem as their future capital. They insist the status of the disputed city is an issue to be negotiated between them and the Israelis. Syrian forces have advanced against rebels in the province of Daraa in their first gain since Tuesday. Reports say both state media and opposition activists Saturday said shelling and clashes are focused on the countryside in the eastern part of the province and the western side of the neighboring province. This is the fifth day of an escalation that saw Syrian troops take villages in Daraa. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says that 18 civilians have died so far since the escalation. That's along with 13 government troops and at least 10 rebel fighters. Also Saturday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres in Washington. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert said the two men agreed to prioritize humanitarian aid in Syria as well as Yemen. Guterres also released a separate statement saying he is gravely concerned by the recent military escalation. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
And I happen to know that just today he has been meeting with these security structures to ensure that the whole country is secured.
Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa escapes an explosion at a campaign rally.
We have always put in place measures to ensure that at each and every place where we are conducting voter registration or where we are conducting polling, security personnel should be there.
The Malawian Electoral Commission is set to begin voter registration Tuesday ahead of next year's general election.
They need to crack down seriously on corruption and on tax evasion. And some of the resulting money, even a small part of it, needs to be actually spent on these social protection programs.
And a United Nations report finds millions of Ghanaians are not benefiting from the country's booming economy. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa met with top security officers Sunday, this after narrowly escaping injury in an explosion at a campaign rally Saturday. The president was campaigning ahead of the July general election. The blast happened seconds after Mnangagwa finished addressing the stadium crowd in Bulawayo, an opposition stronghold. The president said there have been many attempts on his life, that he is used to them. Local media called the attack an assassination attempt. 42 people were reported injured in the blast, including one of the vice presidents. For the latest development following Saturday's explosion, I read George Charamba, spokesman for Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa in the capital, Harare.
The president is happy. The president is at his home. In the incident that happened yesterday left him a bit saddened, not so much because of what would have happened to him, but because of what this means in terms of the peace which we have tried to preserve ever since the takeover.
Is investigation underway to find out the perpetrators of this dastardly act?
The investigations are in full swing, and we hope that before long we should be able to hear some clues in terms of what it is that could have happened on the day and who could have been that perpetrated it.
Are there any more casualties?
Well, we have two vice presidents, and both of them were injured, but the one who took a bit of a harder hit was Vice President Mohadi. He had some fracture on the leg, I think it's the left leg. It's being attended to just now, and he's now in a military hospital. We think he should be up and about before long. But, that's what happens. We had our entire leadership in one place, and that's probably what might have attracted the attacker.
Some people are speculating that this has stalled the president's campaign ahead of the elections, and that this could possibly be an inside job.
As I said, the investigations are in full swing, and my gut feeling is not to prejudge the outcome. I think it's only fair that we wait until we get to know what the investigations will point to. As for the elections themselves, just this afternoon, Vice President Chiwenga is addressing a rally in some city which is very close to this to Harare called Chitungwiza. So really, we are going full swing with the elections, and we don't see this incident as in any way standing in the way of a free, fair, and peaceful elections. In fact, if anything, it does pay us even more to ensure that there is a perfect peace ahead of the poll.
What assurances is the government giving to the people of Zimbabwe following this? Because a lot of people are expressing concern that if the entire leadership of the country could be targeted, then ordinary Zimbabweans are not safe either.
Well, except this seems to be a game that was intended to have a bearing on elections. I don't think really it was meant to create a sense of chaos in the country. In any case, we are a strong state, and the response is going to be as robust as fits the outcome of the investigation. We have been a very, very peaceful and law-abiding nation. Maybe it's the election season which inspires these kind of acts, but whichever way, the government will go all out to ensure that life, limb and property are in fact as safe as is humanly possible.
How are Zimbabweans reacting to this? I understand most of the political parties as well as ZANU-PF members have condemned this as the most outrageous thing to happen and an attack on all Zimbabweans. So how are they reacting to this?
But that's the most interesting thing about it. It doesn't matter which part of the political divide one is coming from. There's this round condemnation of this act because it's very out of character with the society and nation that we have been all along. In fact, the last time we had such events was in 1980 when we had the historic 1980 elections, which saw us transiting from colonialism to independence. Ever since, we have had peace all the way. So really, when an event of this nature happens, the nation is naturally jolted. And when a nation gets jolted, and of course in the absence of clear-cut answers, which are really a factor of the outcome of the investigations themselves, it means people will be looking for the whys and wherefores. So it's only natural that this happens. But I know that before long, we should be able to give some definitive answers to that which has happened so that the nation fears are laid.
I understand President Emmerson Mnangagwa's colleagues in the region, Southern African region and SADC to be specific, have been calling to talk to him, to give him support following the attempt on his life and the entire leadership. What can you tell me about this?
In fact, soon after the incident, we had calls from the Middle East, calls from Africa, and of course, specifically calls from SADC. And that tells you how much Zimbabwean people are, how much the region and, of course, the world over is with the Zimbabwean people when as they go through this very dastardly act. But really, the key thing is for the president, he is the head of state, and therefore the person who must ensure that he stands in loco parentis to the rest of the nation. And that means he has to ensure that there is safety in the country. And I happen to know that just today, he has been meeting with his security structures to ensure that the whole country is secure.
What is the message from the president to the people of Zimbabwe, George?
That hate must be requited with love, and that we should never take this event as an opportunity for retribution or some kind of recrimination which is unfounded. I think essentially it is to ask our Zimbabweans to be patient and wait for the outcome of the results. And then on that basis, proceed on the basis of fact and not on the basis of suspicion.
Joe Charamba is the spokesman for Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa. He spoke with me from Harare. The Malawian Electoral Commission plans to meet all stakeholders Monday in readiness for the upcoming voter registration process. Officials say the stakeholders' meeting forms part of the Electoral Commission's preparation before next year's elections. The electoral body has invited political parties, civil society groups, as well as the public to attend the meeting. It comes as the Electoral Commission is set to begin the registration of prospective voters beginning Tuesday. This, as it compiles a voter list to be used for the polls. For more on Monday's stakeholders' meeting, Irene Sangwani Mwafulerwa, spokesperson for the Malawian Electoral Commission in the capital, Lilongwe.
Well, we are implementing a new system of voter registration. We are abandoning the old one, which was paper-based, going for the biometric one. Now, the implementation of this voter registration is that it will be done in phases. We've got about 8 phases, and we've got about 35 councils to be covered. So on Monday, what we're doing, we are holding stakeholders meetings in the first 3 districts which are covered in the first phase. We want to brief them of all the intricacies that we have put in place, all the measures and strategies that were put in place, so that come Tuesday, people start the actual registration itself.
What is the target of the prospective voters that the Malawi Electoral Commission is seeking?
We are targeting everyone who is eligible to register as a voter. Now, with the Constitution of Malawi, everyone who is supposed to register should be 18 on the date of registration. And those are the people that we are targeting. At the same time, we know that doing voter registration, we cannot do it alone. We need buy-in and participation of stakeholders. That's why we are having these stakeholders meetings on Monday to brief them so that they're also aware, and that come Tuesday, we all move in step.
Is the Malawi Electoral Commission going to involve political parties in this process?
Yes. Elections are about the stakeholders. You need these political parties to participate so that they're also part of the process. And when it comes to acceptance of the process, they should be able to give you a good report about it because they participated. So what we do in Malawi, we always accredit civil society organizations to work with the electoral commission in educating and mobilizing people to participate in the electoral process. At the same time, we know that the political parties have got the constituencies, have got the following. So what we do, we also tell them, advise them to go and mobilize their people. As they are conducting campaign rallies, as they are conducting meetings, they start whatever political message they speak. They should also mention something about the elections.
How about ensuring security where Malawi Electoral Commission will compile the list or the voter roll to be used for the elections next year?
Well, the voters' roll compilation is done at the head office. We are just doing registration in the centers, and then we carry the information to the central point at district level, then transfer to the head office. Regarding security, we are a stable country. Since we started holding elections, since we embraced multipartyism, we have never experienced issues or incidences that have amounted to a high security breach. But that aside, we have always put in place measures to ensure that at each and every place where we are conducting voter registration or where we are conducting polling, security personnel should be there. And this is also the case this time around.
Now, talking about the voter registration phase, political parties, I understand, have been going around trying to psych their supporters up ahead of next year's election. But what is the process of them presenting their candidate? When will that timetable be? And what is the preparation level so far ahead of the voter registration process?
Starting with the population level, we estimate that we should be registering around the 9 million voters if everything goes according to plan. At the same time, regarding nomination or identification of the candidates, there is a time Malawi Electoral Commission will open up. That should be around in January, whereby we will allow political parties to present nominations to the Malawi Electoral Commission. Thereafter, the Malawi Electoral Commission will scrutinize all the nominations received to ensure that they meet the requirements of the law. They announce who is eligible to contest, and that should be around mid-February.
Sangwani Mwafulerwa is the spokesperson for the Malawian Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from Lilongwe. Still in Malawi, journalists and civil society groups are condemning police officers who attacked two reporters from the Zodiac Broadcasting Station, an independent media company. The groups also demanded an investigation into the attack, saying the officers should be made to face the full force of the law. The reporters were covering a joint operation by the Nzuzu City Council and the police to remove street vendors who have reportedly defied an official ultimatum. For more on the latest development, I reach Musasi Cheyu, one of the reporters who was attacked by the police officers.
In the morning of the day, we got a tip that Malawi police is on the ground, mainly in Nzuzu City, where we are based, myself and my colleague. So we went on the ground to do our part, to do our work. But upon reaching there, we had to ask to the police spokesperson, that's for the northern region, who confirmed that they are doing a joint operation in order to get rid of illegal vendors. So we had to go ahead gathering information so that we can write a story by the end of the day. So in the course of doing our work, we had to take some footage, some pictures. And before doing that, we also thought of asking again the public relations officer for police who gave us a go ahead. So in course of taking pictures, my colleague was called by a police officer asking, why are you taking pictures? There are almost over 15 police officers. So they pushed us at the middle and started beating us heavily.
Why did they start beating you after you've gotten clearance from the police officer?
That's what the question we are also failing to answer right now. Why they were beating us? Where we explained to them that we are reporters, we are taking information, and we have been granted permission from your public relations officer. We tried to speak out that, yeah, look, we have the permission from your public relations officer, and you are beating us. What's the problem? Why are you beating us? Up to now, we also don't understand why they did that.
Have the police officials contacted you after their officers gave you a beating?
Immediately after beating us, they took us in a police vehicle. We tried to tell them that we were having our official vehicle. There it is. It was just together with the police vehicle. But they had to take us in a police vehicle going to a police station. Our understanding is that they detained us. But upon reaching at the police station, we immediately called the public relations officer who came at the police station immediately, and he admitted that they granted them permission. So instead of detaining us, they started questioning us, and then they took statements from us. So at the police station, the police officers, the station officer, as well as the public relations officer whom I'm talking here, they said they will just investigate the issue. That's what they said.
They told you they will investigate the issue, but has official investigation begun?
Apparently, I cannot confirm that the investigation has begun, because they just told us that they will investigate the issue. They issued us with a report so that we can get medication at the hospital. So we went to the hospital, we got treated, and now we are looking forward to their investigation.
Some Malawians are asking for you to press charges to sue those police officers in court. Is that something that you and your colleague are considering?
That's what you are looking into. That's what you are planning to do. But then we also need to consult our media bodies. We are working on the company, and we are also under a media body, Mr. Malawi. So I think they will advise us the way forward on the matter. But that's the way we also want to do, because adverse justice must prevail on this issue.
What has been the reaction of the Malawian public following this incident? Because I understand this is not the first time the Malawi police have attacked journalists as well as ordinary citizens.
Malawians who have been maybe communicating to us, they're saying they wonder with what Malawi police is doing right now, considering that they rely on the media to have information, to hear on what is happening in various parts of Malawi. But with this conduct that Malawi police or law enforcers are doing, they are saying they are much concerned. As you might be aware that we are approaching tripartite election, whereby the country will be electing president, members of parliament, as well as councillors. Malawians are concerned. They are worried that with this conduct of Malawi police, how will be having the informed decisions? How will be getting the information from reporters? So that's the main concern that I have observed from Malawians.
Musa Secheyo is a Malawian reporter with the Zodiac Broadcasting Station. He spoke with me from Nzuzu. A United Nations report finds millions of people in Ghana are not benefiting from the country's booming economy, but remain mired in poverty. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights has submitted the results of his 10-day fact-finding mission to Ghana in April to UN Human Rights Council.
UN investigator Philip Alston says Ghana is the fastest-growing economy in Africa and one of the three fastest-growing economies in the whole world. He says this success is making the rich richer, while a high proportion of the population continues to live in poverty. He says the poor are losing out amidst the country's growing wealth because Ghana spends 50% less than its peer countries in Africa on social protection. He says most of the country's resources are being plowed into private investment projects designed to make the wealthy better off. He says this policy comes at the expense of providing better employment opportunities and welfare benefits for the poor.
So the risk is that Ghana continues to be the great economic success story in the continent, but that very little of the wealth will trickle down to a fairly extensive number of Ghanaians who continue to live in poverty.
Statistics show 1 in 5 Ghanaians live in poverty and 1 in 8 live in extreme poverty. Alston says he finds it particularly troubling that 28% of children live in poverty. He tells VOA Ghana has a very big problem of corruption, and the failure of the government to collect taxes strips the country of important revenue.
And that means that they don't have revenue for additional spending. So they need to crack down seriously on corruption and on tax evasion. And some of the resulting money, even a small part of it, needs to be actually spent on these social protection programs.
In response, Ghana notes inequality often affects rapidly expanding economies such as its own, but it says the government is committed to reducing poverty and to achieving the UN's Sustainable Development Goal of eradicating poverty by 2030. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
President Trump signed an executive order Wednesday to keep migrant children with their parents at the southwestern U.S. border, but more than 2,000 children already are living in shelters without their families. Doctors and mental health workers are concerned that some of these children will suffer permanent damage. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
The dream of every family separated at the U.S. border is to be reunited. For a mother from Guatemala, her dream came true Friday, when she was reunited with her young son. They had been separated for a month. She kissed him, wrapped a blanket around him, cried, and told him she loved him. Government video shows children being held in cages, lying under Mylar blankets. They have been placed in tents and shelters throughout the U.S., some as far away from Texas as Oregon. The American Medical Association warned that as a result of being separated from their families, these children could suffer negative health consequences that might last a lifetime. The president of the American Association of Pediatrics, Dr. Colleen Kraft, has taken an active role in speaking out for these children. She warns that children who are exposed to toxic stress do not develop language or other skills at the proper age.
It may take a long time for this trauma to be resolved and these children to be healed.
Dr. Lisa Fortuna is a psychiatrist at Boston University Medical School who works with migrant children separated from their parents. She says the family separations have been going on for some time, and it's very hard on children, no matter what their age.
I've had multiple kids tell me about sort of being, feeling very cold, not eating enough, not having, supports of like their parents or adults that care about them, and that was very, very distressing for them.
Caregivers at some of the facilities where the children are being held say they're not allowed to touch even very young children. Miriam Golden at the Gill Institute for Trauma, Recovery, and Education in Virginia says touch is very important, especially for small children.
When you rock a child, they can hear your heart rate, you can hear their heart rate, and it's through that co-regulation that children can be soothed.
Fortuna says a parent's touch teaches a child that they are being taken care of and loved.
It's a particularly really bad challenge for even younger children who, if they're not touched and engaged with, can become despondent and have very significant developmental sequelae if they are not having the support and touch and engagement with an adult.
Without this support, children don't learn how to relate to others. They lose the ability to trust. They can withdraw and not have any reaction, even if they're reunited with their parents.
We know from science, the adverse childhood experiences study, that needs that children have when they are little, needs that are not met, do lead to long-term problems, not only mental health issues, but other related health issues.
Not every child will have permanent health problems, but young children are the most vulnerable, and the separation from a parent can compound the stress they may have already experienced in unsafe conditions in their home countries. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sport, Douglas Impuga, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. At the World Cup in Russia, in a game that featured scores from the 6th minute until the final moments, Tunisia simply could not keep up with Belgium, which won 5-2 on Saturday, and that means Tunisia won't make it to the round of 16. Meanwhile, Senegal recorded the first African win at the 2018 World Cup when they beat Poland 2-1 on Tuesday, thanks to a deflected Thiago Tchianek on goal and a terrible error by the Polish keeper. Senegal, the 2002 quarter-finalists, could have pressed home the advantage 2 minutes later, but Salih Sané failed to connect with the header. On Sunday, Senegal played Japan, who beat Colombia 2-1 earlier in the day, while Poland will face the South Americans. And Ahmed Musa scored both goals and Nigeria swept aside World Cup debutants Iceland to leave Group D interestingly poised with one round of games to go. The Super Eagles would have gone out with defeat, but came good in Volgograd. The result gives a slight lift to beleaguered group rivals Argentina. Victory over Nigeria in their final game would see Argentina safely into the last 16, as long as Iceland do not beat group leaders Croatia. In that event, goal difference would decide who progresses. Victory in that game for Nigeria, on the other hand, would now guarantee their progress. Having started the day bottom of the group, they find themselves second, 3 points behind Croatia, who have already qualified for the knockout stage. And Cristiano Ronaldo continued his sensational start to the World Cup with the winner as Portugal knocked out Morocco. All eyes at the Luzniki Stadium were on the Real Madrid star after his hat-trick in Portugal's opening game with Spain, and typically he did not disappoint. The North African nation, beaten 1-0 by Iran in the opening game, are playing at the World Cup for the first time in 20 years. And Egypt's hopes of a place in the knockout stages ended with a 3-1 loss to the hosts in St. Petersburg. Egypt played their final Group A game against Saudi Arabia, who have also been eliminated in Volgograd on Monday. Elsewhere, Olympic and World 3,000-meter steeplechase champion Conseslus Kipruto and Beatrice Chepkoech won their respective 3,000-meter steeplechase races on Saturday at Kasarani to qualify for the Africa Senior Athletics Championships. Kipruto, who is also the Commonwealth champion, strategically stayed behind the pack of four before bolting to the front after the last barrier to win in 8.18.05, beating world under-20 champion Amos Kirui from South Rift in 8.18.37. Kipruto and Kirui, the Commonwealth bronze medalists, earned automatic places in Team Kenya for the Africa Senior Athletics Championships set for August 1st to 5th in Asaba, Nigeria. Kipruto declared his intentions for the African title, but said his ultimate target this year is to take a shot at the world record in Monaco on July 20th before heading to the African event. Kipruto holds a personal best of 8.00.12 from 2016 Birmingham and Olympic record of 8.03.28. But Kenyan-born Siad Shaheen of Qatar holds the world record of 7.53.63 set in 2004 in Brussels. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from continent.
Here's a song that comes from Tanzania. Malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Ningekuwa wa maliwe, ningekuwa wa hatata. Nashindwa na mali sina we.
She
can see at all. Living life without your smile. And it's been a while. You've been walking miles. Your usual swag. Never did you want to forget the painful memories weren't gone yet. Remember you used to swear that love could never be fair. Love hits you dead. Love gets you square. Now that you found love, tell me what's up.
Oh baby, baby, can you understand?
How does it feel?
Oh baby, baby, can you understand?
Now that you found love, tell me what's up.
Oh baby, baby, can you understand?
How does it feel?
Oh baby, baby, can you understand?
Couldn't wear your best clothes and your heels were cut low. Didn't wanna try love at all. Said you weren't crazy to fall. With no plans of falling in love, 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 love. So you came here just digging for gold. But then when we came and made love, love hit you there.
Give me rev me up like a storm. Me tell you the truth, girl, me can't keep me calm. Me love how you a flex, girl, me love how you a gwan. The way how you feeling on me arm. Woman, me want me clubbing all the night till the early man. You give me love how you just turn me on. I defend no. Why you feel me love? I can't stick up in a friend no. Y'all the way you had me, give you 10 out of 10 no. Whole bank book me would have spent no. Girl, and when time me and you book again no. Book out hotel and we have spent weekend no. Love you from my heart, from the root to the stem. And the feeling where we have it can't end no.
Hey, now that you
Zobambi matu, mazaka sera na kukume. Gira mani ntakade matu, kaja. Sinkane mkuze, umuze mwaka buzo. Uwero tiana ikwe, we masiru. Kwa uwero wako kachai, nebasa osukai. Nebera bira kajiko. No tete kanya. Yes, more. Let us say hello. So, let's
Zima TV ndio hatari. Meneja umebaki jina nitakia tatale. Ole shabiki zangu waloni sifu kwa maneno matamu. Leo mati zangu ni mitusi tu kwa Instagramu. Kimwa na stadangu eti na yanifamu. Hata mwana izi kimpigia ananifukia kama salamu. Magazeti nyumbani kwa kuku savari. Sunajuaga utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari. Amemwagwa na venye nilivyo mnyonge tabia ya kwa jibu. Sinaga kama naiona michambo ya matemu wa zamani. Nopitiaga nayosema ya ramana. Sababu kuna inajua kesho. Anepanga ni ravana. Bila mificha ni confidential. Ukisa yumba sana mumeo nisije kwa kichekesho. Mana rafiki wa jana dio adui mkubwa kesho. Uje utanipendaga. Auna utanimwaga. Ati utanipendaga. Bado mewaza sana. File tunzo mashauzi ya poti. Itapofika tama kadiri kia tajapo kuni post. Pindi shows imekwama. Nenki
nilipata si jasi ni mikosi. Oh, jasi mezama, mwela ni nusuru baba. Kama na mwana mwanangu, roo yangu, tifada mbote. Anakwenda na mamangu, kwa chaka kikweto na fukuzwa toke. Usilie sandrangu, mwani yangu, chikaze usichoke. Wenda kesho za mwe yangu, nitavuma tena mambo ya nyoke. Nyumbani kwa kuku savari sunajuaga utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari amemwago yelewe na venye nilivyo mnyonge tabia ya kwa jibu sinaga kama na yona michambu ya matema zamani yani karaga na 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 na.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Once again, we are witnessing the United Nations and its institutions being used as a convenient punching bag by powerful member states when they are either frustrated or annoyed. Under the administration of Secretary General Kofi Annan, these member states were able to promote reforms that resulted in the enhancement of their power and influence over the organization while weakening those of medium and small states. At the same time, these powerful member states continue to refuse to reform the Security Council as demanded by small and medium states. One of the institutions that was acclaimed during the era of reforms of the organization was that of the Human Rights Commission that was reformed into a new United Nations Human Rights Council. Its membership was set at 47, and new criteria were approved for the election of its members. It was argued that these new measures and reforms would make it unlikely for the Human Rights Council to be biased against Western countries or Israel, and less likely to elect states that violate human rights. Last week, we saw a change. In recent months, the Human Rights Council and its leadership have become more forthright in criticizing violation of human rights by powerful states across the board. And when the Council and its leadership dare to criticize the United States for its policy of separating children from their parents as a form of preventing illegal immigration, the United States decided to leave the Council and criticize the Council for being so much biased against Israel and other countries. The same arguments that were used against the Human Rights Commission before it was transformed into the Council. This is not surprising, because over the years, it would seem that powerful member states do not mind if the Human Rights Council criticize countries like Venezuela or Ecuador or any other countries like in Africa, Zimbabwe, or South Africa or Tanzania or in Asia, countries like Myanmar or the Philippines. But when they criticize powerful states and their sacred cows, they find it objectionable, and for them it is the time to pick up their marbles and go home. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the lizard that lives high up in the Iroko tree does not hear the lion's roar. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For the last year, the United States has been working to reform the United Nations Human Rights Council into a serious advocate for human rights. Regrettably, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, the U.S. call for reform was not heeded.
Human rights abusers continue to serve on and be elected to the Council. The world's most inhumane regimes continue to escape scrutiny. And the Council continues politicizing and scapegoating of countries with positive human rights records in an attempt to distract from the abusers in their ranks.
For these reasons, the United States has officially withdrawn from the UN Human Rights Council. One of the United States' central goals was to prevent the world's worst human rights abusers from gaining Human Rights Council membership. What happened? The Democratic Republic of Congo, known to have one of the worst human rights records in the world, was elected to the Council. The Council also failed to respond in December and January when the Iranian regime killed numerous demonstrators and arrested hundreds more simply for expressing their views. And then there is the matter of the chronic bias against Israel, noted Ambassador Haley. Last year, the United States made clear that it would not accept the continued existence of Agenda Item 7, which singles out Israel in a way that no other country is singled out. Earlier this year, the Human Rights Council passed five resolutions against Israel, more than the number passed against North Korea, Iran, and Syria combined, said Ambassador Haley. America will continue its proud legacy as a champion of human rights, as the world's largest provider of humanitarian aid, and as a liberator of oppressed people. While we do not seek to impose the American system on anyone else, said Ambassador Haley, we do support the rights of all people to have freedoms bestowed on them by their Creator. That is why we are withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council, an organization that is not worthy of its name.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.